Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Dr. William Hansen, author of Smart Medicine, How the Changing Role of Doctors Will Revolutionize Healthcare. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about a cell phone microscope. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Margaret Flinter.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on one country's unique efforts to combat dementia. South Korea has one of the world's fastest growing elderly populations, and Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia afflict 9% of its elderly population. On top of this, the disease has been riddled with shame and fear in a country with a long tradition of respect for its elders. To deal with this, South Korea has started a campaign to address dementia. Over the past few years, thousands of people have been trained as dementia supporters, trained to recognize symptoms but also to care for individuals with dementia. Hundreds of neighborhood dementia centers have sprung up to help identify the onset early, to educate families, and to give individuals the opportunity to be taken care of at home in their own families. Many of the trained workers include children and young adults. For instance, some schools offer community service credits for students' efforts, which include things like direct care, foot massage at a nursing home, art therapy, physical therapy, dance. And the government is playing a strong role. They've developed a database that allows families to register and track their relatives in case at any time they wander off and are lost. To finance the campaign, South Korea created a long-term care insurance system subsidized with a 6% increase in national health insurance premiums. Building a system of support and education focused on prevention, treatment, and respect, and developing a system to finance those efforts, all in support of those who may suffer one day from dementia? Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. William Hansen, professor of anesthesiology and critical care and medical director of the Surgical Intensive Care Unit at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Hansen has just authored a new book, Smart Medicine, How the Changing Role of Doctors Will Revolutionize Healthcare. Welcome, Dr. Hansen.
Thank you for having me.
You know, your book, Smart Medicine, is the second book in what you call a series on the future of medicine, and you nicely put this into context by tracing changes medicine has gone through in this country from the era of the founding of the first hospital in Philadelphia in the mid-18th centuries, all the way through to the discussions of the latest redesign of the primary care delivery space, patient-centered medical homes. But, you know, underlying all of this, I was picking up this theme that you kept on returning to a number of times about the population that tomorrow's providers will be caring for. They come presenting a disease burden which you characterized as due to discretionary unhealthy lifestyles, choices like smoking, poor diet, insufficient exercise, too much alcohol. Tell me what revolution in medicine is out there to address these chronic diseases, and how's tomorrow's providers prepared to manage these conditions?
Well, I think one of the things that we've done a reasonably good job of, but maybe not as good a job as we could have, is tying the effects of some of these choices to the long-term outcomes. The first disease where we had, you know, a strong correlation between a discretionary choice and a healthcare outcomes was smoking. And if you look back, even to the point when my father was a medical student, most physicians smoked. And in fact, some of the tobacco companies advertised the fact that most doctors prefer this brand or another. It became clear through the 60s and 70s that there was a strong correlation between smoking and lung disease and cancers. And then we had surgeons general like C. Everett Koop making that part of their healthcare pedestal. We have a number of diseases that we now see, and in the course of my lifetime as a practicing physician, obesity has become one of those diseases, essentially brand new. We've had to retool our hospitals with larger and sturdier chairs, wheelchairs, beds, operating room tables. There are new healthcare specialties surrounding the care of the obese, and these are all, and the complications of obesity are essentially due to it. When I say discretionary choices, I mean we've, as a society, chosen to support diets that are that predispose us towards obesity. So I think that, you know, we'll need to educate more and earlier about obesity, and you're seeing children now being counseled in the school system when they're overweight. And I think we need to choose healthier foods for our school systems and for ourselves.
You know, Dr. Hansen, I really appreciated the historical perspective you give in your book, and you set yourself and your own training in that historical perspective. And in a few minutes, we'll probably talk about training the next generation, as we'd like to do on the show. But I thought you told just a particularly poignant story, not about the next generation, but maybe about the generation right before, or the generation that, you know, sometime in the next 15 years or so might be heading toward retirement. You told the story of a cardiothoracic surgeon who'd had a satisfying practice and made a good lifestyle and living for himself doing bypass surgery, and that had kind of evaporated. And here was a guy with incredible training and skills left doing locum tenens shifts, applying for a nocturnalist, a new word in healthcare, position maybe with your hospital. What are you hearing from that generation, and are there any anything in place to help those folks adapt and really transition in these last decades of their careers to a new style of medicine?
That was a very interesting encounter, the one that I described in the book. We think of neurosurgeons and cardiac surgeons as being sort of at the apex of the training system and sort of individual saviors, and I think that that's the way that they thought of themselves going through their careers. And here was this gentleman who suddenly found himself without a job in his mid to late 50s, and looking for something that was the kind of work that most of us would really probably prefer not to do, working at night covering an intensive care unit. I think there are a lot of people in a number of different areas of medicine, and I would include obstetricians in this area, some primary care practitioners who've not found a way to end their careers gracefully because malpractice rates have gone up, or because the calls on their time are such that they can't keep up. And in fact, recently in the New York Times, there was an article about a physician who was a primary care physician who was trying to sell his practice, which was something that one used to do, and couldn't find a buyer. Because that kind of a practice doesn't really exist in the same way any longer, with electronic medical records and other things. So a solo practitioner who didn't have really someone to sell his practice to.
Well, you've hit on a key point, that the world of healthcare is turning on its head for older providers, and yet you started your book off by giving a portrait of the class of 2014 who are entering the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Can you give us, flesh that out for us a little more about what we might see in that medical student? And, you sort of referenced iconically a number of TV type of doctors, and I guess they don't sound like they're the Marcus Welby. Are they the Star Trek Dr. McCoy, or where do they fall on that continuum?
Well, I think that the thing that surprised me in looking at this class, and I was at the white coat ceremony, the initiation ceremony for the entering class of medical students last year, is that they're not too different from the ones that came into my class, or probably a generation earlier. These are outstanding students, many of them with not only an undergraduate degree, in some cases they have a master's or a PhD in other areas. Many of them have done service work either in the U.S. or internationally. They speak and present themselves well. These are the cream of American students, and they still want to come into medicine, which gave me cause for a lot of optimism about the future of the field. are they Marcus Welby or are they Dr. McCoy? I think they're probably something in between. I mean, they come in with the same aspirations to do good works and to take care of other people like Marcus Welby, but they're very facile with electronic devices like smartphones and computers and computerized equipment. Many of them will be working with things like robots or high technology devices in the intensive care unit. So they are sort of spanning that discipline. But the difference is that they're entering a world where they can expect to work 80 hours a week or possibly 60 hours a week in the future, whereas the previous generation trained oftentimes 36 hours at a stretch. They're learning to come in and work as teams, whereas we were taught to be individuals. So they start with team building exercises on day one of medical school. So very different sort of operating principles. Many of them, many students are now doing a lot of their classes online with things like iPads or on the internet.
I'd like to pick up on that theme of medical simulation training and just the radical difference in training that the students have. So probably a fair bet to say that you heard somewhere in your first weeks of training that the history was 90% of the diagnosis, right? And you had your DeGowan at your side and went through all the history taking. Still the case for tomorrow's doctors, or really is it going to be all technology driven? And I'd be particularly interested in your thoughts on the effect of that on cost, up or down. Certainly technology sometimes drives cost down and sometimes in the other direction, in healthcare, usually the other direction. Any thoughts on that?
You know, that's an interesting issue. I would certainly say that technology has been a large part of the increase in healthcare costs. And I think that in my personal opinion and humble opinion here, that's because there's been no emphasis on cost-efficient care, not a major emphasis on cost-efficient care at the front lines. And there's been a lot of rewards and incentives for technology development on the part of innovators and companies. So that we've developed these wildly creative solutions that are admittedly expensive, and that might include something like a robotic approach to a surgical technique.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. William Hansen, author of the new book, Smart Medicine, How the Changing Role of Doctors Will Revolutionize Healthcare. I really liked your analysis of how technologies have influenced new specialties in the field of medicine. And you talk about the transition from telephones to text messaging to social networks and the role systems like IBM Watson could play. I assume play is not playing Jeopardy. But as sort of mobile health becomes more ubiquitous around the world, what new technologies and professional roles do you envision?
Well, you know, it's funny. I just had a discussion about this yesterday with somebody who is working as a technology writer. I think we'll begin to see technology. Medicine used to be a sort of a cloistered, hidden environment for patients. They would go, something magical or special would happen because their doctor took care of the problem, and the patient weren't expected to have any medical information or knowledge about a disease or the drugs, and basically turn their care over to the doctor. Nowadays, we have very informed consumers. Patients who come in with a lot of information about the medications they're taking, about the diseases they think they might have. This is an informed consumer population like it's never been before. There are also applications, and I use the word applications here in the sense of like an iPhone app, that are being developed outside of medicine that will have an impact on medicine. So if you think about fitness applications that are used and available on in some of the mobile phone stores, those sorts of things are going to begin to overlap with medical applications, so that you'll have fitness information integrated with disease or health information in a continuum. And I think that that's going to really change the way people think about disease and health and who owns what part of those problems. But I also think that we're going to see things that new technologies as a result of the increasingly mobile medical workforce. So we have specialists now who have access to their patients' information through their smartphone, through their iPad. People are teleconsulting on issues in Africa, and we have dermatologists who look at lesions that were photographed in Africa moments before. So I think that there's going to be a real sea change in all of those areas as information diffuses out of the hospital and responsibility comes to be assumed to a greater extent by patients for their own care.
Well, that is very exciting work, and we follow it closely. Let me take us back maybe for a moment away from technology and back to human nature and personality. I thought you had a fascinating analysis of, from your perspective, some of the characterological differences, if you will, between people who are drawn to primary care and people who are drawn to specialists. I don't think you'd stick by this as a black and white categorization of the thinkers and the doers. But certainly, you were saying there are real differences, and it behooves us to look at what is satisfying to people and what they enjoy doing. It may explain why still the majority of nurse practitioners go into primary care versus subspecialties. But I'm curious your thoughts as you looked at that incoming class of medical students, and I'm sure you're asked to advise often on the futurist issues in medicine. Should we be looking at these things, looking at these characterological differences between people as we try and solve the problem of the shortage of primary care providers in the United States?
Well, I think that medicine's a big tent. There's a lot of room for people of a whole range of different inclinations, people who are fundamentally researchers and answer seekers, and people at the other end of the spectrum who really enjoy the human-to-human interaction that occurs in an office. There are financial aspects to what we produce. There's been an emphasis in many academic medical centers on specialist care as being of greater weight or importance than primary care, which is it's sort of arbitrary. It could be the other way around. And there are many students, as you well know, leave medical school with a great deal of debt, and the more lucrative specialties tend to be the specialist subspecialty areas, again, and this is sort of an arbitrary aspect of the way we reimburse care in this country today. I do think that we need more primary care practitioners, and I do think that needs to be a partnership between the medical schools and the government. And I actually saw something recently. Somebody proposed that the government make medical education free so as to have greater control over the amount of debt that medical students leave their schools with, and therefore emphasize primary care training. But I think that those are the sorts of things that are going to help us get what we need in the way of a much larger number of primary care practitioners in the coming era.
Dr. Hansen, we'd like to ask all of our guests this question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations on Healthcare be keeping an eye on?
You know, if you look back at history, you see eras over and over again where the medical community had a theory of medicine that guided their care, and the theory there was the theory of the vapors and the humors. We now think of things like prostate and breast cancer as being diseases, but with the coming genomic era, with the ability to actually look at the underpinnings of those diseases, we'll find that we reclassify much of what we now call by one name into other names. And we'll probably look back at this current era as being quaint 50 or 100 years from now, too. So I think that's the kind of thing that we need to think about as we understand more about genomics and what the genes are doing in response to the environment. That's where I think our next area of bold innovation as likely to occur, also using things like stem cells and nanotechnology.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. William Hansen, Professor of Anesthesiology and Critical Care and Medical Director of the Surgical Intensive Care Unit at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. If you weren't convinced that cell phones could begin replacing expensive, time-consuming diagnostics, here's a reason to reconsider: the cell phone microscope. Right now, some of the more promising prototypes out there have the impact to more effectively diagnose infectious diseases like malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV that kill millions of people around the world each year. We can all picture that clunky old microscope that emerged from a plastic cover for high school biology lab. These traditional high-tech optical microscopes we know also cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. In his UCLA research lab, Dr. Idawan Ozjan has been working on a cell phone-based microscope since 2007. The technology, which makes use of the silicon sensor found in cell phone cameras, could cost as little as $5 to $10, according to Ozjan. He says the advanced technology we sometimes take for granted on our mobile phones are extremely attractive to engineers like himself.
In the early 80s or 90s, some of these components that you enjoy in your Blackberries or iPhones would be very difficult to find in most advanced scientific laboratories. So that's kind of a good starting point to think like, well, I have these components available so inexpensively, so can I create new imaging platforms with these components?
It works by passing light through a slide sample, which creates shadows of individual cells on the phone's digital camera sensor. A breakthrough technology like this can also help diagnose these killer diseases, malaria, TB, and HIV, more accurately.
If you show positive for malaria and you don't have malaria but you're still sick and you're given the malaria medicine, then you're not being treated for what you need to be treated for. So what this means is there's huge amounts of waste in medication and money, and we wind up treating people for disease essentially that they don't have.
That's Jason Wakizaka, along with three other graduate students from universities around the country. He and his team developed an app to detect for malaria. According to Wakizaka, they found in some literature up to 60% false positive in tests for malaria in places like sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. The app called LifeLens can be downloaded onto a Windows-based phone. With the help of a small, inexpensive magnifying lens, a picture of a blood sample is taken. Then an image analysis algorithm calculates and detects where the malaria clusters are based on the blood cell's location and staining. Wakizaka and his team are also harnessing the smartphone's GPS capability and trying to prevent disease outbreaks rather than simply treating them after the fact. Both designs have been recognized and put into testing mode. The next challenge will be getting them incorporated successfully into development programs and then making the devices easier to mass produce.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.